Okay, today is December 8th, 2020, and this is the second in a series of interviews with Dick and Mary Bishop, Karen Brewster, Tom Paragai, and Bill Schneider are involved in this discussion. So thank you, Dick and Mary, for taking the time to continue to discuss some of these important issues you've been involved with over the years. I'd like to start with one of the things that you mentioned in the last interview was the public trust doctrine. And maybe if you could take a minute and explain what that is and how it applies to Alaska.
Okay, I'll take a shot at it. Mary may have to correct me, but...
I don't think so.
But the there's a relationship between the federal government and Indian entities, tribes, basically, and the only tribes, I believe, well, that's not true. It's more general, with Native Americans in general. It's called the trust relationship, and I don't know the full dimensions of it. There are certain aspects of it that are more formalized, I think, than others, or at least better known, such as trust lands. But in general, it's an obligation, perceived as an obligation of the federal government to attend to the well-being of Native Americans.
I don't think this is what he's talking about, though. Isn't there, what Warren Olson was always talking about?
Am I on the right track, Bill, or not?
Well, I think what you're talking about is the federal trust responsibility to American Indians. And what I was asking about
was
the public trust doctrine, which is a national doctrine that deals with conservation issues.
And okay.
Tom, maybe you could provide a little more perspective on that to get us in the right direction.
Well, I guess I'm not quite sure of specifically where you wanted to go on that. Maybe you could rephrase the question, Bill.
In one of the earlier interviews, Dick did talk about the public trust doctrine, which is a wildlife conservation doctrine that deals with North America and conservation areas and notions of access and sustained yield and issues dealing with conservation. But if we don't have...
Okay.
We can go to another question.
I think I'm on the right track now.
Okay.
I think I'm on the right wavelength now.
Okay.
There is what's called the public trust doctrine, and it's based on the collective history of, I guess you could say, English and American law regarding the responsibilities and the authorities on conservation of wild resources. And what it boils down to is that in principle, the resources belong to the people, not to the state, nor to the federal government, and that the responsibility for providing for the well-being of those resources and the uses of them by people falls to the states as opposed to the federal government, with the exceptions of international treaties. That's kind of the short story on it.
Okay. Well, let's leave that one as it is then. And I'll go to the second question I have. In your guest opinion piece for the Alaska Dispatch News, the one that you sent to us this past week, you reported on the subsistence summit that was held under the Hickel administration. And you concluded that subsistence is a civil rights and fairness issue. You also mentioned this in your interview with Kathy Harms, when you also said it was a matter of principle. And I wondered if you might explain that. Subsistence as a matter
yes. of principle. Yes. I would start first with a correction. The subsistence summit that I believe I was referring to was that held by Governor Knowles in 2001. I may have referenced in the remarks, and I don't remember now, that Governor Hickel had a subsistence advisory council, which he formed to attempt to develop legislation to address a subsistence priority in state law rather than tackle it with a constitutional amendment. So there's two different things there. One was an advisory council to Hickel. The other was kind of a public show by Governor Knowles trying to promote at the end of his second term a constitutional amendment for a rural priority in Alaska's constitution.
And which one were you referring to in that ADN article? I thought it was the Hickel administration.
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't remember.
Okay.
The specific wording. But I guess it's probably, I consider it fair to say that in the course of both of those involvements and other ongoing debates about a subsistence priority, that it became clear to me, and I think obviously to many other people, that what it came down to, and it was kind of confirmed by the Alaska Supreme Court in the McDowell case, that it was a civil rights issue. And I think it was Justice Moore on the Alaska Supreme Court in the McDowell case said, this is an equal rights issue and an easy one at that. So that came to me kind of late in the game. We were arguing about fish and game allocation, and suddenly it became clear that we were talking about the question of equal rights among Alaskans. And there are two quotes I would add from other people that really sort of summed it up. One was by Senator Gary Wilkin of Fairbanks, who was in the Senate at the time near the end of at least one of the rounds of the ongoing discussions. And his comment was, in voting against a rural priority amendment, that you don't vote away your civil rights. And the second quote that I remember, because it seemed to be so relevant and meaningful, was by a lawyer named Chuck Robinson from Soldotna, who was very active in fish and game litigation over the years. I don't know if he's still active. And he testified on an earlier occasion to a House, I think it was a House hearing on the question of a rural subsistence priority amendment. He said, if this passes, it violates my civil rights. I am black. I know about civil rights. If this amendment is adopted, it violates my civil rights. And those two quotes have really kind of summed it up for me in terms of attempting to achieve equity among Alaskans in the opportunities to use Alaska's wild renewable resources. A third quote that I remember because it was so imponderable was by, I think, then Representative Ethan Berkowitz at Governor Knowles' 2001 summit, when in the course of the discussion, I think I brought up the question of equity, equal rights, and Representative Berkowitz said, well, if it comes to a choice between equal rights and justice, then I'm for justice. And I've never been able to figure out why he may have believed that you could achieve justice if you had not achieved equal rights. So that all of that kind of put it in the focus for me. In an ongoing condition, plus Supreme Court's ruling of being a civil rights issue.
Yeah.
Could I butt in here for a minute?
Sure. Move your head into the screen a little bit.
Okay.
There you go. That's good.
I'm hoping I can... If I could encourage you to take that sheet of paper that I sent to you all, is it only in times of shortage, for a history to me that points all this out. It starts with a quote from Senator Stevens who says that rural and native people would receive a preference whenever there's a regulation to be made, basically. And then the next point is when the Department of Interior says all other uses must be eliminated before customary and traditional subsistence use by rural residents can be restricted. And that was written in 95 and again in 61. And there's
81.
And there's references to where that was. And then the thing that really hit it on the head was when Holland ruled in 1989 before the Supreme Court, Alaska Supreme Court, ruled in McDowell. And the Alaska Supreme Court ruled that the priority was unconstitutional. But basically, he said that the Board of Game can rarely, if ever, put bag limits and seasons on subsistence hunting. Basically, because what was customary and traditional was year-long hunting, and everybody knew this. Customary and traditional meant year-long hunting and no bag limits. And eventually, as it notes down here, Judge Holland approved almost year-round seasons with a community bag limit. And then the Alaska Federation of Natives, in their no net loss policy in 1996 and 97, said as one of their points that the subsistence priority applies at all times, not just when there is a resource shortage. So AFN knew and agreed on that. And then I remember this in particular. I was sitting in the audience when Representative Con Bundy asked the AG, please define for me what is the administration's version in times of shortage. And I remember when White responded, virtually, in my idea of times of shortage, demand versus supply were always there. And I can remember looking at in particular Representative John Davies' face at that moment, and he glanced at me, and it was as though, yes, there's recognition that, yes, it occurs all the time. Whenever there are regulations, whenever there is a priority. Finally, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that the term priority within the meaning of ANILCA is allowing a balance. But that was in 2000. So ANILCA passed in 80. After 20 years of lawsuits, the Ninth Circuit ruled that the language is not an absolute priority, but the preference is always, a preference must be given. And so what we, and we were having all these lawsuits and arguments in between 1980 and 2000, trying to figure it out. But what we've got here is a situation that is so common throughout the nation. It's not just subsistence, it's so many things. Basically, the question is, when equality is not the standard, how much inequality is justifiable? And the courts are dealing with that all the time. When equality is not the standard, how much inequality is justifiable? We do it with minority rights. I'm trying to think of that term. Affirmative action. We do that all the time. And how much inequality is justifiable? Now I think it was about in 2000. We have a book that's really useful, and Richard just found it, and it's reminding us of all sorts of things. It's called Alaska Subsistence, a National Park Service Management History, and it's written by Frank Norris. And as we read it, it's thick. It reminds us of 20 years of living this between 1980 and actually after 2000. But this book is, I think it was written in 2002. And as we read it, we're just reminded of how much we were living this. And one of the things that I wanted to bring up in relation to this was that, maybe Richard, you recall, I thought I had this bookmarked, but oh, here I do. This year's, however, Knowles' effort was met with lukewarm support for a constitutional amendment. AFN leaders in response hurriedly organized a day-long conference in Anchorage. They emerged from the conference vowing for the first time ever not to support a constitutional amendment. Instead, they passed a resolution urging Congress to develop a native and rural priority in managing the resource. Based on the lack of support, Knowles Bill's founder, we remember that when the effort was no longer for a rural priority, but a rural plus native priority. And on it goes, and now it's basically a federal subsistence board issue that they deal with regard to how much inequality is justifiable.
On federal lands.
On federal lands. All done with my soapbox.
And I guess I would just add that, Bill, that now it's more clear that we really are talking about just federal lands, not federal lands and waters, because the Sturgeon case made it very clear that navigable waters are under the jurisdiction of the state rather than the federal government, which produces another round of complications for everyone, I guess, agencies at all.
Yeah. Well, let me take a opposite perspective and have you react to it.
Please.
If you're living in rural Alaska, whether you're native or non-native, and you're dependent on a life subsistence lifestyle, as both of you have been at different times, and you're dependent on state land, state fish and game management, and there comes a period of shortage, the question is, should you have any more right to that resource than somebody from the city who might want to fly out or travel out on a road that might access that area and have access? And as I understand your position, everyone should have equal access. So the limited resource in that situation that I just described would go to everyone, and there would be no priority for the person who was, in my estimation, most dependent upon it, the person whose lifestyle and situation was dependent on the resource. So how would you react to that one of, that would seem to me to be the justice question as opposed to the civil rights question?
There are, well, first off, we have to, for me, perhaps, we have to get past the term rights. To me, a right is something that you receive through the Constitution. A privilege is something that is given by legislation and can be taken away and given and taken by the Congress. That was defined.
Or the legislature.
Or the legislature. That was defined to me by Bill Horn, who is an attorney very active in this issue back in 80. So it is a privilege. It's not a right. And okay, we recognize that. But the second part of this, the issue of whether or not somebody in rural Alaska should have better access can be and has been addressed through regulations by the Board of Game and probably by the Board of Fish, where I'm more familiar with Board of Game. But the Board of Game has often made regulations that, I can't think of the word, that favor the rural community over the non-rural community simply by the way it's made, by the way the regulation was made. And I think this is justifiable. I have no problem with it. When they make regulations that allow hunting at certain seasons of the year that make it difficult for non-resident hunters to go there. Richard, perhaps you could, there's several ways they do this, and I think Richard knows more than probably Tom Paragai knows more about how this works too.
But I think Tom referred to it in the previous session, and there are regulations in place now that involve three different aspects of characterizing opportunity or regulating opportunity. One is community hunts, and the others are tier one and tier two subsistence hunts, and they all involve some level of qualification that have to do with dependence, history of dependence on the resources and available alternatives and so on. And I don't know if Tom wants to elaborate on that. I don't remember the particulars well enough to elaborate much. But the point being that there are provisions in regulation in place to take into account differences in people's history of use and reliance on the resources. And your picture, Bill, just blanked out. I don't know if that
picture of me.
There we go. You're back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you're back. So there's that. And prior to the big, prior to ANILCA, basically, or prior to the implementation of ANILCA, the Board of Game regularly established things like controlled use areas, and there are other provisions where if you wanted to hunt for, let's say, big game of some kind in a particular area, then, and it was put on a permit hunt, you had to go to, for example, McGrath to get a permit. I think some of those things still are on the books. So there are ways to adjust, I guess, or modify the regulations to give greater opportunity for those that can verify, basically, longer-term use and relatively fewer alternative resources available.
I can remember that Sam Harbaugh was chair of the Board of Game about this time, and he really went into detail about how many different ways the Board of Game had worked at this to make things more available to the local residents.
And so did Sydney Huntington.
Oh, yes.
Sydney was in a tough spot, you know, being of Athabascan and mixed Athabascan and white origin, but very, very much a part of the Native community. And he felt that the things that the Board of Game had done prior to ANILCA and subsequent state law were appropriate and effective in accommodating local rural people. So, you know, I guess it's fair to say nothing's perfect.
Right.
You get a lot of complaints about the hoops that people may have to jump through that are rural, and you get a lot of complaints from non-rural people about having to go to Kaktovik to get a permit for hunting muskox. So, anyway.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned community hunts. Were you talking about the community harvest program?
Yes. Yes.
And I think at one point you voiced disapproval of that. Is that true?
Yes. Because it was very, when it was initially started, it was very slanted. It was very prejudiced in favor of local rural communities and the people in them, to the point of being
unconstitutional,
discriminatory with regard to the general the provisions in the Constitution of equal rights and equal opportunity. It got modified, and I think not necessarily to the benefit of anyone, to the point where I think now the regulations say that not only can people from a town or a village apply for community permits, but other people can form a community in the context of hunting and go through the same drill of verifying the membership and the past use, et cetera, and compete for a permit to use a particular resource.
But the first way it was passed did go to court, and it lost in court.
Yeah, it was prejudicial, and it wasn't sound. So, and the other thing that's interesting, you know, this it's kind of one of those rabbit chases, I guess. They go to down different holes, but I thought back to the time when we lived at Minchuna, and I had complained about the Park Service's ignorance, apparently, of local uses, which everyone described at that time, that's 40 years ago, as subsistence uses, hunting, trapping, fishing, in the bush, principally. And so I wound up doing this report on what were called subsistence uses in the North Addition to the McKinley Park at that time. And so I grabbed my notebook and I went off across the lake to where the rest of the people lived and got in touch with an old-timer named Leonard Minkey, who was a white guy married to a native lady from Anvik. Very nice couple, and both with long, long experience. And Leonard was an exceptional outdoorsman in many ways. So I said, well, Leonard, I'm here to document subsistence uses here around Minchumina and in the adjacent terrain and people's dependence living on subsistence uses. And the first word out of Leonard's mouth was, nobody lives on subsistence anymore. And I was shocked. I was really surprised. And it turns out what he was getting at was he was comparing his perspective, which was by then already 40 or 50 years old, with the time that I was talking to him, and how much the uses and means of use of wild renewable resources had changed in that time. In his opinion, it just wasn't subsistence anymore. People were not totally dependent on direct use of those resources and making do without modern conveniences. And that was kind of an eye-opener. You know, it dawned on me that, yeah, there's more than one way of looking at this. And the most basic way would be to say that subsistence depends on living off the land. Well, anymore, no one really lives off the land to that extent. And if anyone starves, it's very likely their own fault. About 10 years ago, I'll just add a note here. There was published in the Alaska Magazine an article about the reliance on subsistence resources and the native, Native Health Consortium is as close as I can get it right now, was quoted as pointing out that at that time, no, this is 10 years ago or so, that over 50% of food that Alaska natives use is at that time commercial. And that was quite a surprise to me too. And it said of the remaining part, the main reliance on local resources is among the elder people. So, you know, what that documented was a real change in the level of reliance on those local resources that had occurred over time. And the other element of that that comes back to me from time to time is that in the discussion of reliance on those resources, too little attention has been paid to the people who are not rural, they may be suburban or even urban, whose circumstances are at least as demanding or difficult as people in rural Alaska. And they very much rely on the use of fish and game for food because they may have low incomes and so on. They're just kind of a neglected part of the picture most of the time. But they're in similar circumstances. If it were not for the opportunity to harvest wild food resources, their quality of life would be quite diminished. And we were in that situation for many years.
And I have to add, at this point, you know, we're 82, 83 years old, not up to hunting the way we used to. And we rely and are so pleased when our three sons, and in particular another neighbor, provide us with fish, bison, caribou, moose. It's wonderful to have family and neighbors that do that. We appreciate it.
It's kind of a community thing in that way, even though it's just part of the larger, in this case, the larger Fairbanks community.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can certainly appreciate that and see that perspective. I think that the rural dependence, though, is of a different magnitude, and the question is whether the state is able to accommodate that dependence under existing fish and game regulations. And that's probably nothing that we're going to be able to solve today, but it is the pressing question. And
it is a pressing question, and one of the things that presses it hard is the meteoric rise in rural village populations that have gone from very small, like 100, 200 or something, to 500, 600, 700.
Bethel. Thousands.
Well, Bethel's off the chart in that regard, but some of the outlying ones, and it comes to light in particular in a somewhat different scenario with regard to marine mammals, belugas in particular. The belugas in certain locations like Kotzebue Sound are in desperate straits because between the expanded population of people there that do harvest beluga, their populations are really threatened. But the same thing applies if it's Chifornik or Old Chivac or whatever. You have several hundred people that are living in places that once adequately, if not lavishly, supported 100 or 200 people, and now you have 500 or 700 or more. That's a very different circumstance, and there's no way in hell that with the most liberal regulations that even Judge Holland would approve of, that the local resources can support the population that's there now.
Yeah.
And
there's another issue here. Maybe Richard can expand upon it. Sometimes the environmental community is a real hazard to this. And I think Tom also, when there are people who depend upon a caribou population, but the caribou are being decimated by predators, and because it's on federal land, they can't have any federal predator control.
We're going to come back to that. We're going to come back to that question in a minute or two. But Karen, why don't you ask the question about the Alaska Outdoor Council?
I just had a couple of follow-ups on the subsistence quickly, and Tom might have some questions too.
But we will come back to the predator prey.
Yeah, that's one of my questions: is the predator prey. But the idea, these definitions of subsistence and this article about in times of shortage, in that article you mentioned the criteria for customary and traditional use. There's these 8 criteria that are, I guess, the Board of Game is supposed to apply to decide if something is qualified as a subsistence hunt. And I didn't see anywhere where those criteria are defined, and you may not remember all 8 of them specifically, but can you talk about those criteria for customary and traditional use? It was in that document about the Nelchina herd. It says, if the harvestable portion of a game population is not sufficient to provide a reasonable opportunity for all subsistence uses, the Board of Game shall distinguish among Alaskan users through tier point system involving customary and traditional use. And the state has 8 criteria for what that customary and traditional use 8. Are.
The Board of Game at one time did adopt 8 criteria, and I can't remember to what extent they may have appeared in Anelka, and in which case they would have previously appeared in the state law that passed in 78 that preceded Anelka. But I don't remember that there are specifically 8 criteria. So offhand, I can't remember the 8 criteria. I don't have the regulations handy. I don't know if Tom would remember them or be able to paraphrase them or not.
I recall that they were heavily involved in a lawsuit that attorney Mike Kramer was arguing, and it had to do with fisheries.
Oh, it could be. I don't recall. So anyway, I guess to be as brief as I can, I think the board still considers a set of criteria like that, and whether they're exactly the same as the 8 criteria that were previously adopted, I've just lost track of.
Yeah, it says here that in your article here that the 8 criteria have been modified after the McDowell decision. And location of residency cannot be a criteria for being a state subsistence user. But the wording of the criteria still implies rural use patterns. And they were adopted by the Federal Subsistence Management Program. So are those, what might those criteria be? Tom can maybe answer that generally. And then, are they applied, and how are they applied today?
Yeah, this is Tom. I just pulled it up on the website here. As Dick and Mary mentioned, it can be applied by the Board of Game or the Board of Fisheries, depending on the stock they're looking at. The 8 criteria are the length and consistency of use, seasonality, methods and means of harvest, geographic areas, methods of handling, preparing, preserving, and storing, intergenerational transmission of knowledge, skills, value, and lore, distribution and exchange, and finally the 8th one is diversity of resources in an area, economic, cultural, social, and nutritional elements. And some of these factors, when you apply for a Tier 1 or a Tier 2 permit, these are some of the factors that are applied there.
So who's applying those criteria? If you're applying for a permit, that means the Department of Fish and Game is applying those criteria?
That's correct. You as an individual, Karen, you and I, we live in Fairbanks, but we could apply for Tier 2 permits for an Alchina, Caribou, or other areas. We fill out the application, and then you submit it in, and there's scoring that's applied for the different factors in there. So you can go to on the website and look at the Tier 2 permits and see what those are. It has to do with how many years you hunted that population, the degree that it fulfills your food needs. Also, they look at the cost of fuel, and I think the cost of food in the community where you live.
Okay, because the reason I was asking about it, too, is it brings up the question of the confusion between state application of the word subsistence and federal subsistence regulations. You know, when someone says it's a state subsistence hunt, that kind of means something different in my mind than maybe what the state is intending by using that word.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at the regulations. Go back to the 1970s through the mid-1980s, there was actually substantial sections in the state hunting regulations explaining subsistence. now when you go in them, there's just a couple of brief references to community hunts and tier two hunts, and that's about it. But as Dick mentioned, it was a 1978 law. And so if you go back in the regulations back in the late 70s and early 80s, there's actually several pages describing how state subsistence hunts are administered.
And so if it's a hunt on state land, state subsistence laws apply. If it's a hunt on federal land, federal subsistence laws apply?
That's something you'd have to probably talk to somebody in our regulation sections about. It's complex enough that I don't understand all the nuances of it.
I didn't know if Dick might be able to explain it.
Well, I think in general... I think in general that state regulations apply wherever hunting is allowed, be it state or federal lands. But for example, in a national park like Denali, not in the preserve, but in the park, no hunting is allowed. It's prohibited.
Right.
So they don't apply there. But on the preserve or in other areas where hunting is not restricted to rural people, which is quite often the case, state regulations apply, but they may be modified in federal regulation. For example, I'm thinking of a case that I think pertains to Minchumina. I can't remember exactly, but the moose season runs a certain length and 20 C's in state regulations, and I think in the federal regulations there's an extra 6 days or something like that. So that sort of thing does happen, but it's kind of at the crux of the matter, as the legal matter, as to who has the last word on what the regulations will be, and that was a recent issue where the Park Service had said that certain state regulations would not apply on Park Service preserves that involved hunting bears in dens and hunting wolves late. And those restrictions were revoked under the Congressional Review Act, which was it was unusual, I guess. But it is a mechanism where Congress, if they get the backup, can actually override administrative regulations by agencies.
Hmm. And I just want to make sure I understand correctly what Mary was saying with the myth of the times of shortage and what came out of all that is what you're saying, that subsistence should be given a priority all the time, no matter whether there's a time of shortage or not?
Are you asking me what I think it should be, or are you asking me what it is now legally?
Both.
Okay, legally, the priority is always present. As it says on the sheet of paper, a priority based upon customary and traditional use, but it now only needs to be a meaningful use preference rather than an absolute priority. So it negated the second sentence up here, or the second thing, where all other uses must be eliminated before customary and traditional subsistence use can be restricted. That was the interpretation in 1995 and the state AG in 1981. It negated that, but it still allows a meaningful preference must be given. And, it's all the time, and it's for customary and traditional use. That's the legal business. Is that clear or muddled?
It's a bit muddled in my mind. But perhaps it's muddled in the law as well.
Pardon?
So it's muddled in my mind, but it may be muddled in the legal framework as well. But so what you're saying
that
is...
That would not be... This, the, one of the things that always... I remember when you talk about it being muddled. Sometimes, you know, legislation is like, what do they say, making sausage at midnight or something like that. Congress and legislatures make a law, and then if they just want to get it out of their hair and get rid of it, they don't always figure it has to be well worded, and they depend upon the courts to clear up the befuddlement. And that is precisely what has happened here. And so now the courts, after 20 years, they finally got it to where it's not an absolute priority. It's a preference, a meaningful preference, but it is always there, and it's a preference for customary and traditional use.
Okay.
And it doesn't depend on whether or not there's alternative uses, or doesn't depend on need. It depends only on customary and traditional use.
And it doesn't depend on if there's a shortage. It's a preference all the time.
Right. It's a preference all the time.
Okay. That explains the legal. Now, you were going to share your thoughts on it.
I think if there is a preference, it should be based on need. But like Hammond said in one of these quotes, you know, individual need is really difficult. But I really am offended when people say, well, we have to have king salmon because that's what... we've always customary and traditionally used, and now we've got sure plenty of silvers and chum, but we don't have the king. So we, and there are so many alternative resources out there. We used them. You know, we ate whitefish. We ate an awful lot of whitefish. If you don't have moose, you eat caribou or fish. And that was customary.
Beaver.
Or beaver. It was customary to eat these alternative resources when the typical one was not harvestable. So, yes, I would like it based on need. But that I recognize that is terribly difficult.
Yeah, how one defines need then becomes a whole nother subject.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, that's right, and that's a changing scenario as time goes on. And that's why I brought up the reference to the letter or the quote from the Alaska Health Consortium, Native Health Consortium.
Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
Yeah, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, who pointed out, and it was quoted in that article, that... half of the food eaten by Alaska Natives, and that's the way they put it in general terms, was store-bought, basically.
Was this in rural villages or statewide?
Statewide. They were referring to the foodstuffs in general but used by Alaska Natives, which... kind of surprised me, but that's what they said.
Well, if it was statewide, it may have been influenced by how many Native people have moved into the urban centers of Anchorage and Fairbanks, and that might be affecting their use of wild resources.
Yeah,
it could be. It
would certainly make sense if it was statewide, because... like they say, the biggest Native village in Alaska is Anchorage.
Right.
Yeah, this is Tom. What you were just describing about some of the changing uses of resources, it was Sidney Huntington in his, I think, 1993 book, Shadows on the Kayakuk, talked about changes in use of species that were not common, such as moose was fairly uncommon in the Kayakuk area back in the 1930s. And they noticed over time how they spread into there and had become a very important resource to the people there locally. But from what people talk about, tradition is a context of their memory and how far back you can document that. And so moose, a century ago, really wasn't the main part of it. They were much more eating caribou, beaver, and salmon in those areas.
That's another thing. Beaver is so nutritious and was so commonly used as an alternative resource, or I don't know, perhaps even a main resource. And now people don't even think of using it. And I think there's places in Alaska where there are so many beaver that you can actually shoot them.
Well, that's a lot of places in Yukon, Kuskokwim Delta is a place where beaver have expanded. And that concerned people in the tundra villages because they felt that the beaver might be impeding the well-being of whitefish, which were basic traditional food for forever. So, that's the kind of change that alters things. Plus the fact that in that same area, moose have expanded. So I think today, for example, compared to, let's say, 40 or so years ago, moose is a relatively common and available resource, and it wasn't back then. They were very sparse. In fact, state seasons were restricted, and I think that preceded, actually, the restrictions preceded Anilka, for example. Anyway, I don't know where you want to go next, Bill.
Bill, do you want to go predator prey or outdoor council?
No, I think we should go to the Alaska Outdoor Council.
Okay.
Bill, do you want to maybe take a break there? Dick and Mary are moving around a bit. I wonder if they wanted to get up and take a stretch break or something.
I'm okay, except that I'm sitting on a very uncomfortable stool.
I'm okay.
I'll get a cushion for this stool.
Coffee pot's out of reach.
I think we'll run for another 30 or 40 minutes and then call it, and if we need to, we'll have ask for a third interview.
Also...
I'm sorry, I didn't get that, Bill.
Maybe another half hour.
Yeah. The best interviews run about an hour and a half. And after that, it's much harder to keep a good focus. So I think we'll probably go just another half hour or so.
Yeah, The way this is being recorded, I'm not sure it's recording it, but not necessarily the same way I did it before. So anyway, so let's talk about the Outdoor Council for a little while. That we know you guys were heavily involved in that organization. So can you talk to us about the years you were involved and the various positions you held with the organization and issues the organization and you personally worked on?
I would just add a question about why you got involved and how you got involved.
Yeah, maybe we should start with explaining what the Alaska Outdoor Council is.
Part of that didn't come through clearly.
If you can explain what the Alaska Outdoor Council is or was, and how you got involved and why.
Okay. The Alaska Outdoor Council was formed, and that's a short title, on the foundation of the Alaska Sportsmen's Federation and Wildlife Council. That was an agreement between Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association, Mat Valley Sportsmen's Association, and territorial sportsmen in Juneau.
In 1955?
Somewhere in the mid-50s. And they were very active in issues relating to fishing and hunting regulations for many years. And just kind of gradually diminished in activity. And so when Anilka finally passed, it became clear that there were going to be a lot of huge changes in the way things were done. And the effort was made to reorganize that previous council on a new format, and it was called the Alaska Outdoor Council, and there's a longer name, but the main purpose was to provide a means for the outdoor clubs in Alaska, which had proliferated in the meanwhile, originally with the original Alaska Federation. There probably were only those three clubs that were really functional as hunting, fishing, trapping interest clubs. But in the meanwhile, by the time 1983, when the Alaska Outdoor Council was reformed on that basis, there were many more clubs. And so included in the new organization was the opportunity for clubs to join as members of the Alaska Outdoor Council. And a prime motivation was, as I said, just to find an effective way, try to find an effective way of dealing with the substantial changes that seemed on the horizon with the passage of Anilka. Well, it didn't take long to find something to worry about, because with a lot of areas off limits, in a sense, under federal jurisdiction, the potential rule changes that we've already discussed, and so on, a much greater role of the federal agencies in access and potentially in hunting and fishing regulations, there were a lot of issues. And one that came promptly to the fore was the federal subsistence priority. So that became a main focus, one of the main focuses for the Alaska Outdoor Council. And it went back to many of the things we've already discussed here, the question of equal common use and equal opportunity to use Alaska's resources, and even went to, as I mentioned, the history of English law relating to the public trust doctrine. And the Alaska Supreme Court in 1989, when they ruled against what had become a state law with a rural priority and declared that it was unconstitutional, had gone through the history of the development of the public trust doctrine at length, going way back to Old England. And that was very, very instructive. So from there on, it went, the Alaska Outdoor Council continued to be active in state regulatory matters, access to state and federal lands, and there are many provisions of federal law that relate to access on federal lands, such as RS-2477 trails, and in ANCSA, such as 17B easements through newly acquired private holdings by Native corporations that provided access to state lands or private lands beyond from a main access route across those private lands to state lands, for example, beyond that private property. So there's a whole bunch of things that came about. And Then there were lawsuits like the Katie John lawsuit, which originally was first in state court, and there was a settlement there, and it was then pursued further by the lawyers for Katie John as a federal case, and that's a long and detailed history. And ironically, I'll just throw this in, I'm told by people that live in that area that nobody fishes at Matsalinas anymore, which is the traditional fishing spot for people from Intasta and Kitty John in particular. And it was kind of the poster depiction of the need for access to, a priority access to those fishery sources. And it got further confounded by the Federal Reserve Waters Doctrine, which is probably still of some legal infirmity, but hasn't been since addressed in court. It came up also, I think it was about 1989 or thereabouts, that there was a conflict between the Ninth Circuit Court saying, yes, the federal government has an interest in managing resources in these waters because of the subsistence issue, and they have the right because those waters are integral to the integrity of federal conservation system units, versus a case that came up in the Alaska Supreme Court where a guy got busted for shooting deer out of season or over bag limit or some such thing in coastal waters, tidal within state tidal waters, and the Alaska Supreme Court said the federal government has no business in tidal waters or on navigable waters. But the Ninth Circuit Court was not bound to pay any attention to the Alaska Supreme Court. So it paid no attention to that perspective on the legal issue and simply went ahead and ratified the idea of Federal Reserve waters. So innumerable issues, an iteration of issues like that kept coming up. And even within state law, for example, the Alaska Outdoor Council objected to the original community hunts that we talked about just earlier a little bit, and other regulations as to their appropriateness with regard to opportunities for people, with regard to harvest levels, with regard to management to provide for the beneficial uses to Alaskan residents in general. And there you get into the matters of habitat management and predator-prey management. So all of those things have been ongoing issues for the Alaska Outdoor Council for years. Our involvement was pretty significant, mainly relating to the subsistence issue. And of course, we got involved. Mary was involved when ANILCA was going through. I was still working as a state employee, so my participation was representing the state's concerns. But after that, then we got involved. Mary is editor of the newsletter for decades, and myself in one capacity or another as either an employee or volunteer or whatever, and lobbyist for the Alaska Outdoor Council. And I kind of finished up, I guess, in early 2000s, 2001-2002, with Tony Knoll's last attempt to get a constitutional amendment on subsistence. I spent a lot of time in Juneau opposing that on behalf of the Alaska Outdoor Council. And successfully, as it turned out, the legislature chose not to approve a resolution for a constitutional amendment. So that's kind of the short story. I guess we've continued on in various ways on different issues, contributing one way or another, and probably the most important in recent times has been supporting the sturgeon cases. There were two, and being very pleased with the second round in the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court made it very clear that the state had the authority to manage the waters and the resources in them and state navigable waters. There's still a problem there because verifying that they that they are state navigable waters is still kind of a daunting gauntlet to run for the state. That's not efficient. The BLM administers it, and it's a very difficult, slow process, and not an easy thing to get done, even though many water bodies have been agreed to as being state navigable waters. And an important thing that people forget is that I forget is that the tidelands are also state waters, and those are very important in many places.
So, Dick, were you representing AOC when you lobbied against the Knowles effort?
Yes.
Okay.
And also, when I was on Governor Hickel's Subsistence Advisory Council, I represented AOC on that as well. And that was an interesting group. It was quite a spectrum of people involved, ranging from Alaska Native representatives. I was trying to find a list of everybody that was on it, but I don't have one handy. But, for example, Mitch Dumitov was a prominent spokesperson for Alaska Natives. There are people with general interests, Eric Farr from Juneau, John Burns, marine mammal biologist from Fairbanks, a fellow from Cook Inlet, Driftnetters, and a variety of other interests were represented on that. And the whole effort was to try to come up with legislation that would satisfactorily accommodate a subsistence priority. And let me just add at this point that today there is priority in state law for subsistence uses as well as in federal laws, just administered differently. Anyway, that was the point of it all, and Governor Hickel put in two different bills. The first one was defeated. We went back, and actually there were two different councils, and I was on the second one, and that's when he was able to put together a bill that finally did pass with quite a few revisions, but it set the stage for what we have today.
Is that this one?
And one of the... excuse me, one of the big discussions in that advisory council was that came up was, well, what about culture, ensuring the ability for Native culture in particular to survive in this situation? And the group, which had some very good discussions, actually, Jay Hammond by then was retired, and he was on that commission as well, or that committee. And we had quite a heated discussion over how to acknowledge and address culture, Native culture in particular. And it threatened to be a sandbar that we were lodged on. And I finally wrote something up that wound up as the first part of the findings in the state law that did pass that acknowledged the importance of Native culture and the fact that many Alaskans since had adopted many aspects of that culture and the nature of use of wild renewable resources, respect for them, conservation of them, and so forth. And that was adopted by the committee, and it became, in a kind of an odd sort of way, it was adopted as the findings for the bill, the Hickel's bill, subsistence bill, that did pass. And you won't find it in the statutes of reflecting the new state law. It's in, what's the name of it? Temporary and Special Acts and Resolves, 1992. And I hope to be able to send that to all of you. Anyway, it's very hard to find in the records of statutes, but unless you know where to look. Anyway, that got us past the impasse over recognizing and acknowledging culture. And the real trouble with trying to do that was that came out in the discussion was that it's all well and good to recognize the importance of that to Native people and to other people who have benefited from it, like us. But to somehow measure that or be able to measure that and put it in regulation was just virtually impossible, because cultures are kind of amorphous and they change. And so it just became an impossible task to try to encompass that in state law, and that's why this findings sort of eased the group past the sandbar. I don't know. Let's see. So I was on there on behalf of the Alaska Outdoor Council and sort of secondarily on behalf of urban, non-rural, non-native hunters, fishers, and trappers, and some of the other people represented either no particular interest except in conservation of fish and wildlife, or in some other user aspect, like the drift netters in Cook Inlet. They had a big stake in it, because that was and is still an important and difficult issue as far as management of the salmon resources in Cook Inlet.
So, Dick, were you on the Alaska Outdoor Council while you were still working for Fish and Game? Was that allowed, or was that a conflict?
I was a member, but I was not any kind of an official. I didn't get more active as a board member and so on until after I retired from Fish and Game.
Okay. So
there was one other incident, though. It was kind of related.
Okay, I'll put him outdoors.
Okay. My dog is bugging me. Wants attention. We got this 5-month-old Labrador puppy that weighs 60 pounds. I think he thinks he's in charge, and maybe he is. Anyway, what was I going to say?
It was something in response to being on the AOC and not being a state employee, and when you got more involved, you had some story you were going to tell.
One more issue you wanted to discuss.
It may come back, but go ahead.
I guess as a state employee, you couldn't lobby for the AOC, and so.
Oh, yeah. Now I remember one other incident. There's all kinds of incidents related to all this continuum of things revolving around resource management and subsistence. One was the state law that passed that did state of priority for subsistence use was objected to by a lot of people, and a petition was submitted to repeal it. And I did support the petition mainly on the basis that I felt the law was not equitable. And about that time, the administration, state administration, changed, and I think it was under Governor Sheffield that he was bound and determined to defend that law, and maybe I think he was also looking for a constitutional amendment. At any rate, there was quite a ruckus about it, and quite a few people from Fish and Game signed up as supporters of the petition.
32, I think.
I think it was 35. and so their names quickly became public, and they became known by people who opposed them as the Dirty 35. And when Sheffield got in, there was a concerted effort to get rid of the Dirty 35, which failed. And fortunately, along came a change again in administration, and the heat was off. That was kind of an interesting interlude, that names and I think even in some cases pictures were published of people who supported this petition opposing the current federal state law, and a lot of criticism of people who took that position.
I started with the Outdoor Council in 83, right when they began, and became the editor, and published with the help of other people, obviously, a quarterly newsprint. I remember being so proud watching that first one rolling off the press. Actually, looking at the newsprint on the big round things that go around down there at the News Miner. That got published pretty much quarterly until 1990, and then it switched to an 8.5 by, well, after I finished, it switched to an 8.5 by 11. And so I followed and wrote about a lot of this stuff, but did not follow it as tightly and closely as Richard did, especially after. Well, he was just always involved in the subsistence stuff, so he understood it better than I. But then we had a sort of a division of labor when the native sovereignty issue and Indian country issue came around more in the 90s, more prominently. I followed that one more closely. So it's a division of labor, yes.
And the sovereignty issue is of concern for the Alaska Outdoor Council and others also because of the potential. Because when you have trust land, a sovereign tribe, that entity is exempt from state and municipal rules, and it posed the potential problem of having differing regulations for fish and game on a lot of different areas, substantial lands, and to try to reconcile such a diversity of priorities or preferences or desires among many groups that had authority over some patch of land in the middle of, say, a caribou migration route or moose habitat or trapping country or whatever was really, really kind of scary. So that is also a resource management concern, and it was a concern and is a concern of the Alaska Outdoor Council. And recently there's been a little more emphasis from in particular on identifying what they call traditional use areas, as though there was still some precedent of
Aboriginal rights?
Aboriginal rights, ownership, management, and so on, as opposed to a general interest in the lands and resources well-being. And that comes up once in a while, and it seems to me that I don't know exactly how to put it, but it seems to contradict the basic premise in ANCSA that traditional native rights based on use and occupancy were abolished with the passage of ANCSA, and it went on with other provisions to provide for Alaska Natives, the corporations, and so on. So it just seems like in many arenas, there's always a level of dissatisfaction with conditions as they are, and a desire of some intensity to change things. And traditionally, I guess is one word, conventionally, from the standpoint of Native interests, the alternative is to turn to the federal government. And there we get back to that first question I got on the wrong track about, and that's the federal trust relationship with Indigenous Americans. So it's kind of interesting.
And it all gets back to this one question: when equality is not the standard, how much inequality is justifiable? That's what the courts deal with all the time.
I think we need to stop here, and this is really something we need to explore further. And so if we could have another session and come back to this land and trust issue and sovereignty and the federal trust relationship to Alaska Natives. And I think that would be good for us to think through that in a more extended way.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to point out that I don't know if you read it, I had a piece in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner on Sunday addresses that.
Yeah, I'm most interested in Dick's comment about the subsistence issue as it might relate to that. So that's something we could pursue.
Mm-hmm. Subsistence. Mm-hmm. Oh, and the other thing that I'm fascinated by is this book by Frank Norris that we just discovered, that was written in 2002. It's just a wonderful resource on the subsistence issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It documents a lot of the things that happened. For example, like Bill, you asked me if there had been a native preference in Anilka at the outset, and I could not remember. I remembered hearing about it, but I couldn't remember if for sure there was. So I looked it up in this book Mary was just mentioning, and sure enough, probably the first Anilka bill, HR 39, that Morris Udall submitted, it was probably the first one. There may have been some other drafts of some sort before that. Anyway, he had a native subsistence priority in that bill. And it didn't last very long, because apparently shortly thereafter, the Governor Hammond pointed out to Congress that the state could not deal with the racial priority if they were to take over management under an ILCA of Fish and Game, which is what a lot of people anticipated was going to happen. So it was there at the outset, but it didn't last too long.
And the book has got a really good index, and it talks about reserved water rights doctrine, and it's documented by a lot of professional writing and newspaper articles, and as my son, a journalist, always says, newspapers provide the first rough draft of history. Emphasis on rough.
That's good. Well, and I think that book by Frank, I think that's focusing more on the federal side of subsistence, since it's a National Park Service publication.
Correct. It emphasizes the, but it wasn't, it talks about how the, it was a national law. It talks about how it developed, who the main players were, all the newspaper articles, in reference to it, the McDowell case, which of course was a state case. Right. So it gives a wonderful history.
Yeah, it's the implementation of ANILCA and subsistence in Alaska National Parks. And I think, Bill, you have to go, right?
Yeah, if you'd pardon me, I need to scoot out.
Okay.
But let's reschedule. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, okay, thanks.